It's the Indie Weekend, read by John Federson. And our issue today, August the 25th from 2021, is presented for our audience of blind and print-impaired folks by your North Carolina Reading Service. And our music today from Tex and Shirley's Theme Songs for the Masses. They're providing our music today. Now, they're located right off the bypass, and they say everyone's welcome to try out a theme song right off the rack. The custom work is also possible. And thank you very much. We'll hear them at the end of our show today. Now, as we often do with Indie Week, the online edition of IndieWeek.com has some later information than our publication date of August 25th. This is being the 26th, so I will read from both. And the first one will talk about FDA's approval of the Pfizer shot, which many of us have already heard about. But here's what they have to say. The Pfizer BioNTech coronavirus has been won approval from the FDA. Don't expect to see a national vacation mandate coming from the Biden administration. Local governments, however, in the private sector, to be sure, will be a different story. According to Mark McClellan, former FDA commissioner, physician, economist, and now director of the Margolis Center for Health Policy at Duke University, the full approval of the vaccine could motivate those who have been vaccine hesitant. Quote, I do think it'll make a difference. Many, maybe not a large number of people running out and getting a vaccine today. The vaccine will now be marketed under the name Comirnaty. According to a Duke press release, McClellan's work at the Duke Center focuses on strategies and policy reforms to improve health care. In addition to serving as FDA commissioner, McClellan was an administrator with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He currently serves on the boards of Johnson & Johnson and Cigna. Each company is involved in aspects of the COVID pandemic response. McClellan said the fully approved vaccine offers important reassurances, quote, that even though we're in the midst of a pandemic, the FDA is applying all of its gold standard regulatory approaches. Everything it does in normal circumstances when we're not in a pandemic, you'll see there were no corners cut. They were very diligent in all this. The former commissioner said, quote, the agency needed to be really careful not to do anything that after the fact could be viewed as cutting corners and undermining the confidence that was intended by the full approval process. He noted that just over 70% of Americans who are eligible are partially vaccinated, while 87 million Americans who are eligible remain unvaccinated. And he said out of those, according to some recent surveys, about 30% say the full approval of Pfizer vaccine would make a difference in their decisions. He adds the federally approved vaccine should help the vaccine hesitant to overcome their doubts. Quote, we know it's very effective. We know there are rare temporary side effects, but the benefits do seem to clearly outweigh the risks. He also pushed back on some of the misinformation regarding the vaccines causing infertility or altering one's DNA that has contributed to a rise of new cases and deaths as a consequence of the Delta variant. He noted that misinformation is not supported by the data. On the other hand, the effectiveness is, he added, saying the vaccine's approval will have a significant impact on businesses, schools, college campuses, and entertainment venues, along with state and local governments that may now require vaccines in settings where people have to be together and there's a high risk of transmissions. Those things are going to bump up our numbers, he said. The health policy director was hesitant to suggest that the FDA's full approval and vaccine mandates would lead to government-prompted vaccine passports, though he noted that the private sector and local governments have already begun to impose vaccine requirements. McClellan explained, the Biden administration has been pretty clear all along. They do not see a federal role in requiring or administering a vaccine passport system. That said, we have seen a number of state and local governments impose something like vaccine requirements for indoor dining, indoor sports events, indoor entertainment. I expect to see more of that happening. I also expect to see more of that happening in the private sector. He said, so far, one of the most important findings about the vaccine at this point has been its effectiveness and safety, particularly for the Pfizer vaccine, in preventing infection and hospitalization. He noted that, although the effectiveness rates are slightly lower than numbers used in December, that we can attribute to a longer follow-up and more challenging variants now. Quote, it's really good news that the effectiveness data is holding up. On the safety side, the trials of tens of thousands of people found no evidence of serious long-term side effects. All right, continuing with online, Lee Taus now talks about our Lieutenant Governor. Mark Robinson's indoctrination report is a load of bullcrap. You could take the time to read through Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson's 831-page report, published yesterday by his Anti-Liberal Indoctrination Task Force, FACTS, or I could save you the trouble. It's a load of bullcrap. The report, if you can even call it that, is comprised of about 500 submissions from members of the public detailing perceived instances of liberal brainwashing in public schools, most of which have to do with things like parents being mad that their kid's teacher wore a BLM shirt on their Bitmoji during virtual school, or assignments that have kids reading propaganda from extreme leftist outlets like CNN. The report's findings were a foregone conclusion, given Robinson's need to drum up controversy, see critical race theory, for his base in time for 2022. Robinson found indoctrination, which the report itself does not define, but can be deduced to mean, quote, anything in a school smelling remotely liberal that pissed me off in every region of North Carolina. Although the report didn't find any statistical pattern to the endemic liberal coercion, quote, there seems to be more concentration in more of the urban areas, it concludes. But Robinson's report doesn't actually show indoctrination is happening in North Carolina in any meaningful way, as former Indy editor Jeffrey Billman points out. Only about 3% of submissions would violate House Bill 324, advancing in the legislature, which would forbid 13 concepts from being promoted in schools. Those concepts include ideas like moral character is determined by race or sex, meritocracies are sexist or racist, and the, quote, United States government should be violently overthrown. The vast majority of submissions were just paranoid parents being pissed off about something their kid told them happened at school that day. Here are some examples. My nephew came home yesterday from school and informed me that his teacher laughed in his face when he said George Washington was the best president. The teacher laughed and embarrassed him and then told the class the only right answer was Obama. My daughter was raised with sound biblical values, the golden rule, etc., but just 3 short years, public school turned her into a full-blown socialist. She graduated about 15 years ago, but even to this day, I cannot have a rational conversation with her regarding anything significant. The indoctrination and hate-mongering has gotten worse in our society. You see it everywhere. In every classroom, we need to remove or discourage socialism, critical race theory, et al., and anything else that promotes socialistic indoctrination, Marxism, and hatred. Or at the very least, teach the Constitution and the freedoms it espouses in a positive light. Teach both sides. My daughter will not tell me any specific incidents, as a true socialist would not do. But the fruit of public education stinks. We need school choice now. Then there's just a bunch of folks who want to rant. Liberal left-wing indoctrination of students could be ended almost immediately with one simple action, ending professor and teacher tenure. When an employee has guaranteed employment, no industry but teaching has this, for life, he or she can say or teach anything they like with no fear of consequences. I no longer want my tax dollars funding a socialist tenure system where my kids are being taught depraved communism with no end in sight and no way to punish those who are perpetuating the indoctrination. End tenure now. about 100 submissions were just making fun of Robinson or berating him. Mao is being taught to my 7-year-old in Wayne County. The Reds are trying to convert my child. This study is a joke. Why is the Federated States of Micronesia even listed here? You are a joke, Mark Robinson. Take your guns and your big lies and out of our schools, you nasty Nazis. These submissions, all 506 of them, were taken at face value. With no follow-up investigations as support that indoctrination is somehow the biggest crisis befalling North Carolina public schools and not, you know, understanding the pandemic or crumbling infrastructure. I'm sorry, Mr. Robinson, but that's not how facts work. You don't just say something is a problem, ask folks on the internet if it is a problem, and then publish what they say is proof that you're right. This report is as devoid of facts as Robinson's head. It belongs in a dumpster, along with every campaign sign for Robinson 2024. All right, lawmakers approve anti-protest bill. Legislation heads to Cooper's desk by Jane Porter, also from the online Indie Week. While dodging COVID and ostensibly fumbling toward a state budget, North Carolina lawmakers somehow still found the time to ensure that free speech and the right to protest made it to the chopping block, or maybe to the chilling block, rather. Yesterday, House Bill 805, a proposal originally introduced by House Speaker Tim Moore, cleared the North Carolina Senate in a 25-19 vote along party lines. The bill, known as the Anti-Riot Bill among proponents, would increase penalties against those who engage in undefined rioting. The bill also requires a judge to set bail for anyone arrested during a protest, which will ensure that they spend time in jail. Opponents of the bill, including Democrats and civil rights groups, say the legislation will have the chilling effect of stifling free speech, the right to assemble, and will discourage peaceful protests. Moore filed the bill 10 days after Andrew Brown Jr. was killed by Pascagoula County Sheriff's deputies while peaceful protests were ongoing in Brown's hometown of Elizabeth City. Moore made no secret of the fact the bill was introduced as a direct response to the BLM protests that erupted around the country last year in response to the police killing of George Floyd and other instances of police brutality. Here's more on the bill from the Associated Press. Quote, "But many Democrats and civil rights groups fear the measure could have a chilling effect on free speech and assembly rights by instilling fear among activists and dissuading them from going into the streets to voice their frustrations. Among many things, the bill allows business owners to sue people who damage their property for 3 times the actual damage they incurred, as well as court costs and attorney fees. Protesters who assault emergency responders would be charged with a more serious felony, even if the victim was not physically injured. Additionally, those charged with rioting or looting could be held in jail for up to 48 hours, conditions similar to those placed on defendants charged with domestic violence." Senator Natalie Murdoch, a Durham County Democrat, quote, "It sends a message that will cause people to police themselves and simply stay at home." The American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina is among those opposed to the bill as it considers the proposal a flagrant attempt to vilify the Black Lives Matter movement. Emancipate North Carolina, the state NAACP, and Democracy North Carolina also oppose it. The bill returns to the House for concurrence before it heads to Governor Cooper's desk. Cooper already expressed concerns with the bill at a news conference last week, the AP reports, and said lawmakers should adopt policy recommendations from a task force to address racial equity in North Carolina's justice system that his administration commissioned last year. He said, "We shouldn't have riots, and people who take part in riots should be prosecuted. That needs to be said first. But also, we made significant proposals about racial equity in the criminal justice system, and some important common sense changes that need to be made in that bill doesn't include any of them." In a spot of good news, though, the legislature approved a police reform bill that includes some of the recommendations from Cooper and Attorney General Josh Stein's task force, including measures designed to remove unscrupulous officers and provide other officers with mental health assistance. All right, a week ago, The Indie Week began a three-part series, Legacies of Lincoln, shining a light on the mighty Tigers football team from Chapel Hill Carborough's segregated Lincoln High School. And this next article, The Second Wave, 1963 to 64. J.A.C. Dunn wrote in the Chapel Hill Weekly, "The real reason the Lincoln Tigers can't lose is that they won't." It was November 1963, and Thomas Bell was running again, but this time he was grown, and he was fearless. This time he wasn't alone. Bell was now a star on the mighty Tigers, and his first quarter rushing touchdown, as well as a 100-yard pick six on the defensive side in the fourth quarter, helped Lincoln demolish Nash County High in Nashville, North Carolina, 36-0. Under the leadership of quarterback Fred Baldwin, Lincoln headed into the Eastern District playoffs not only undefeated, but also without giving up a single point all season. Williamston's Hayes High finally scored on the Tigers in the Eastern District final, but Baldwin and Bell led Lincoln over Hayes, 25-12. The undefeated team was back in the championship game. Like the Tigers' 63 football season, the desegregation movement in Chapel Hill was reaching a fever pitch. In late December alone, around 200 people were arrested at protests and sit-ins, including 8 arrests on December the 20th for blocking the sidewalk in front of the Tar Heel sandwich shop. The direct action took place only a couple of weeks after the championship game, which Lincoln lost to Winston-Salem's Anderson High. But though the season was over, the Tigers' fullback had made the Chapel Hill Weekly again. Quote, "Those arrested, in addition to the three leaders, Thomas E. Bell, Negro." 8 days later, a group gathered at Carlton's Rock Pile, a convenience store and gas station on East Franklin Street. They sat on the floor when they were refused service. The owner, Carlton Mize, locked the doors from the inside. Knowing the demonstrators' vows of passive nonviolence, Mize brought out bottles of Clorox and ammonia and poured them onto the heads of those gathered. Several protesters were taken to the hospital. After their stomachs were pumped and ointment was given for their burns, they were thrown in jail. James Fouché, a former Mighty Tiger and the brother of movement leader Braxton Fouché, was one. Mize was never prosecuted. The struggle continued to escalate early the following year, on February 1st, 1964, on the four-year anniversary of the Greensboro sit-in. 75 people were arrested in Chapel Hill at various sit-downs in streets and at restaurants. A week later, Braxton Fouché helped organize the largest demonstration yet. Immediately following a UNC men's basketball home game against Wake Forest, hundreds of protesters choreographed synchronized waves of sitting or lying in the streets. They blocked the intersection of Franklin and Columbia Streets, as well as many of the roads out of town. With thousands leaving the game, chaos ensued. The police threw demonstrators into a used bread truck that became a makeshift paddy wagon, and the pot continued to boil. A month later, James Fouché, along with three others, held an 8-day fast in front of the Franklin Street post office. The fast honored anyone charged with trespassing or obstruction, now up to 1,500 people. The New York Times reported on it daily. On the north edge of Chapel Hill, the Ku Klux Klan rallied 700 people. 3 months later, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, outlawing segregation in public places. But denial of service and physical violence continued in at least two restaurants in Chapel Hill. Though tensions simmered all summer and into the fall, football carried on. It was Fred Baldwin's senior year, and the Mighty Tigers gave up only 8 points the entire season in an 8-7 loss to Durham's Merrick Moore High, which went on to win the state title. From the St. Joseph's CME Church basement this July, I sat with Fred Baldwin and Jimmy Weaver as they remembered and lamented the name of the Merrick Moore player, Kenny Davis, who scored the final points to beat the Tigers. Weaver recalled Baldwin running the ball on a desperate option play and missing the end zone by inches. As an upperclassman in high school, Fred Baldwin received a scholarship to North Carolina College, which is now NC Central University. Just like at Lincoln, he did the improbable. He started at quarterback as a freshman. And I might add that since this is first person, Joel Srantz is the author of this article about Lincoln High. By some measures, rays of light began to penetrate one of the darker periods in Chapel Hill's and the country's history. In 1968, Albert Williams, a former Mighty Tiger fullback and one of the Chapel Hill Nine, became the town's first black firefighter. The following year, Braxton Fouché was elected the first black alderman in Carrboro, serving until 1981. Also in 1969, his friend Howard Lee became not only the first black mayor elected in Chapel Hill, but the first in a majority white municipality in the South. But where some lights shone, others were extinguished. In 1966, 2 years after the Civil Rights Act, the doors of Lincoln High School were closed to the community that once thrived within them. Not long after, the once bright lights at Lyons Park were switched off for the last time, taken down, and disassembled. The field was paved over and developed, making room for new apartments. In Chapel Hill, throughout the decades that have followed the Civil Rights Act, the difference between desegregation and integration became increasingly clear. Mismanaged integration, intentional or not, has kept equity at bay. On a stormy morning in late June, I met Braxton Fouché at Weaver Street Market in Carrboro. As we talked, he'd howl with laughter or swell with pride, retelling stories of agitating all the right people in every decade from his Mighty Tigers days to the present. But when I asked about the new home for Lincoln's football trophies after all the students were moved to the new Chapel Hill High School, miles from town, he stopped and looked me dead in the eye. Everything at Lincoln was thrown away. When the doors to Chapel Hill High School, the same one that sits off Homestead Road today, opened in 1966, all students in town attended. But for those who came over from Lincoln High, nothing was familiar. Very few students walked to school anymore. Whereas Lincoln High was less than a mile from many black neighborhoods and churches, the new high school was almost 5 miles away. The award-winning Lincoln Band could no longer gather on its campus and march down Franklin and Rosemary Streets for homecoming games or Christmas parades. What's more, by nearly every measure, CHHS remained a white school. While it might have been desegregated, black students had to assimilate. It kept the name of the White High School. The Wildcats mascot remained for several years, and students sported the same school colors as when the high school was all white. Coach W.D. Pierman, who had led the Mighty Tigers to his undefeated state championship in 1961, was now an assistant to a white head coach. Lincoln's beloved principal, Mr. McDougall, was also an assistant to a less qualified white person. The teachers were overwhelmingly white, and many held prejudices against the new black students. Lincoln's student newspaper, the Lincoln Echo, was gone. The black community's parent-teacher-student association was gone, and so were the trophies. When the Lincoln Building became the school district office after its students left, Braxton Fouché remembers one day when word spread that the Lincoln trophies were sitting in a dumpster behind the school. Only a few were recovered. Yet the most damaging consequences were not the material ones, not the school's location, nor the mascot, nor the trophies. Mismanaged integration creates a haunting legacy. In late June, I met Dave Mason, Jr., one of the Chapel Hill Nine and a former statistician for the Mighty Tigers, at the Chapel Hill Public Library with his daughter, Danita. His Lincoln recollections were clear and proud, and his laughter easy. But so was his anger. Mason, Jr. said, "Our schools were desegregated in 1966, but we have, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the second highest achievement gap and one of the highest economical gaps in the country. Now, how can this happen in Chapel Hill?" When the systemic reproductions of structural racism are allowed to endure, the barriers to racial equity bob and weave like the heads of a hydra. The monster survives any solitary beheading. Racial caste is reconfigured. But even in the wake of racism, erasure, and in neglect, many people have sustained the spirit that flourished at Lincoln and have maintained its history. Trophies may get thrown away, but some lights cannot be extinguished. The Marion Cheek Jackson Center in the building next to the church basement where Baldwin, Weaver, and I sat in July preserves the struggles of history. Similarly, Mason Jr.'s daughter, Danita Mason Hogans, lights innumerable new candles, as she now carries the torch for progress. Mason Hogans, whose Chapel Hill roots go back 7 generations on both sides of her family, is an activist and community historian, two roles that come as no surprise to her. She told me a lot of the people on the 1961 Mighty Tigers football team were mentors. They were like uncles to me. And a lot of the values and things that went on from that team were passed on to me and informed my activities in the 80s and the 90s. So it was never a thought of if I should become involved with social justice efforts. It's how. It was a continuation of that legacy. The legacy to which she refers, her father's generations, might have already had its heyday, but their fire is not extinguished either. Dave Mason Jr. isn't done fighting. Quote, "As far as I'm concerned, it's good to call attention to the fact that you see something wrong and protest it," he said of young people today who are working towards equity. "I'm saying, hell, do something about it, okay? Don't just talk about it. Let's do something." From the church basement, Baldwin and Weaver agreed that the fight must go on. "Everything is not as it should be," said Baldwin. "And you wouldn't know about it unless somebody raises some hell," Weaver added. Baldwin sees the same patterns: perceived supremacy, prescribed social order, enduring in the world around him, particularly via the will of older white generations. He said, "They think they're supposed to have superiority, and that you're still supposed to stay where you are and stay in your class and don't ever progress. Just stay where you are." That's the sad part. We're constantly living in today's world from yesterday's world. It's still there. It hasn't gone anywhere. This week, Education Week, a national platform for education news and information, published a story that echoes Mason Jr.'s frustration and anger and cites research behind the figures that he mentions. The authors wrote, "So if Chapel Hill is so progressive, then why does our district have the second largest achievement gap nationally for black students and the fifth largest for Latinx students when compared with white students, as recently described by Stanford University researcher Sean Reardon and his colleagues? Barriers like the achievement gap are rooted in slavery, then segregation, and then mismanaged integration." In Reardon's research, parents' income, their education, and the degree of segregation in the neighborhoods they live in predict a large part of their children's test scores. These barriers are unknowingly upheld by the people who thrive in the system that perpetuates them. The authors aren't academics or professionals. At the time of the publication, they were 2 students at Carborough High School, located less than 2 miles away from where the building that housed Lincoln still stands. In the wake of George Floyd's murder last spring and frustrated by the enduring systemic inequality around them, the 2 students co-founded the school's Black and Brown Student Coalition, BBSC. 60 years after the Mighty Tigers' undefeated season, students of color at Carborough High School still faced institutional racism, including an achievement gap that's a bastion of white supremacy. With an intention that would make Mason Jr. proud, this generation is doing something about it. And until his graduation in May, one of the authors and BBSC co-founders, Phoenix Garayua Tudrin, was a quarterback at Carborough High. And next week, hopefully, we'll read part 3. Young people once again have to shoulder the burdens of the reality they face. A small interlude now, still from Indie Week, from the photo archives. Last week, Maple View Farm and Milk Company in Hillsboro announced it was discontinuing milk production and bottling after 25 years. Their popular ice cream shop and country store will remain open, with ice cream made with a dairy base sourced from Simply Natural Creamery in Iden, North Carolina. Maple View Farm finds its origin story back in 1963, when Robert Bob Nutter, a fifth-generation Maine farmer, relocated to Hillsboro and purchased 477 acres. Legend has it he began milking cows the day he arrived. Since 1996, when the farm began bottling its own milk, Maple View's slender glass bottles have stocked refrigerators around the triangle. In the announcement post, Maple View wrote the closing had been, quote, a very hard decision, and the cattle are all going to a good home and will be missed immensely. Now, the cover story from this issue of Indie Week is titled Hive Mind, and it's about local beekeepers. It's written by Lena Geller. To my left, Jackson Brinkley has just paused a reverent soliloquy on the Queen to hand me a jar of what looks like Turkish delight. For a moment, it feels like I might be in Narnia, not standing next to a beehive in balmy Watt Hillendale backyard. It's not uncommon to get a sense of otherworldliness when you're around a beehive. According to beekeepers Brinkley and Alfredo Salkeld, Brinkley says people have been watching bees since ancient times. It's very magical the way they all work together. Brinkley and Salkeld make up two-thirds of the team behind Buddha Bee Apiary, a company with a Host a Hive program that allows people with no beekeeping experience to house beehives in their backyards. Founded in 2019 by Justin Manis, Buddha Bee aims to show folks the value of beekeeping without forcing them to commit to the rigorous, complex care that the hobby usually requires. For a monthly fee of $150, the Buddha Bee crew will install a hive, care for the bees, and harvest the honey, while using the hive as a living laboratory to educate hosts on sustainability and beekeeping tactics during their tri-weekly inspections. And while Manis is currently away doing remote management, he's traveling cross-country with his family and a school bus that he renovated into a mobile home. He's found devoted co-workers in Brinkley and Salkeld who do the day-to-day management. Before starting at Buddha Bee, Salkeld didn't have his own hives, but he was so interested in beekeeping that, quote, any time I was traveling, like visiting friends in New York, I would look up beekeeping on Instagram and message random people like, this is weird, but can I come see your hives? Brinkley, meanwhile, has been beekeeping on his own for 5 years and has 12 hives in his backyard. He asked his friend to make custom beekeeping pants that have a holster for his hive tool and elastic near the ankles to keep those bees from crawling up his legs. Today, writes Lena Geller, I'm accompanying Brinkley and Salkeld on one of the 90 inspections they'll perform in the Triangle this month. At this time of year, Brinkley tells me, hive inspections primarily involve monitoring for parasites called varroa mites, which transmit 30 different diseases among bees. If left untreated, the mites can wipe out an entire hive in a week. I peer through the grated lid of the jar I'm holding. It's not full of candy. Rather, bees wiggle, covered in powdered sugar. Brinkley explains this is part of the mite test. He says, we take a scoop of about 30 bees and put some sugar on them, which makes them clean each other off, which makes the mites fall off. The mites fit through the holes in the lid, but the bees don't. He continues, so he can shake the jar, count how many mites fall out, and use that number to deduce the number of mites in a whole hive. If the mites look to be overly pervasive, he'll treat them with an insecticide. Manis says, mites are one of the main reasons we're losing a very large percentage of our bees today. We're replenishing the populations when resources are abundant, but making more bees in preparation for these losses isn't necessarily a long-term solution. Beekeepers have yet to figure out a sustainable remedy to the mite problem, he says, but raising colonies locally instead of purchasing them from out of state something that Buddha B is on track to accomplish by next year, is a step in the right direction. Manas says, Varroa mites spread so quickly because we're constantly shipping bees around the country. Raising your own bees combats that problem, and it makes for a stronger, healthier honeybee because they're more acclimated to your area. Educating hosts on the challenges that honeybees face is part of the Buddha Bees team's mission during inspections. Saltcode says, beekeeping is a gateway drug to caring about the environment. I've seen people spraying mosquito spray all over their yard. That just kills butterflies and everything else. But then they get a beehive and suddenly they're like, wait, I'm invested in not killing the things around me. And they switch to more natural alternatives. And as Brinkley adds, fostering a sustainable environment for pollinators can have an actual quantifiable effect. He says, quote, we have a host who runs a garden for a Catholic church. The years before they had a hive, I believe it was 20,000 pounds of produce that they gave away. The year after getting a hive, it was 45,000 pounds. Durham resident Robin Kirk, who hosts the hive that I observed in person, says the bees helped to spark inspiration for the second book in her fantasy trilogy, The Hive Queen, which came out in September of 2020. And Kirk says, I didn't realize at first that honeybees are actually not native, they're cultivated. So as someone who also writes science fiction, that's really cool. We've engineered nature in so many ways, even in so-called wild places, which often makes climate change feel more addressable, because if we've created nature, then maybe we continue to think about it creatively so we don't kill ourselves. Kirk splits the monthly fee with three of her neighbors. The hive benefits all of them from a pollination and educational standpoint, she says, and they all get a cut of the honey. She says, my neighbor actually uses the honey for baking. I mainly use it for hot toddies. It's a nice little benefit, but as we have said to each other, it's the most expensive honey in the world, so that's not why we do it. We do it because it's a way of keeping in touch with the world around us. Leotas, now news from Raleigh. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin confessed to feeding a feral cat last week while debating a proposed wild and dangerous animal policy, and said she wouldn't stop even if fined. It turns out she may already be violating city code. She jokingly invited the city's animal control unit to fine her for feeding a feral cat outside her ritzy downtown Raleigh condo during the city council meeting last week, while discussing a proposed ordinance that would ban the ownership of wild and dangerous animals, as well as the feeding of local wildlife. Turns out she may have to pay up. Baldwin is already violating city codes, say two Raleigh public safety officials, and could face a fine of up to $500 or even a court summons as a result of feeding her furry friend. The cat may have caught Baldwin's tongue in a text to the Indy. Baldwin said city attorney Robin Tatum advised her, quote, there are no ordinances that prohibit feeding feral cats. Tatum emailed the Indy reiterating that and stating, I know of no facts that would indicate that the mayor has violated any city code provision. Tatum might be half right. The policy doesn't explicitly ban folks from feeding ferals, but three sources within city government say Baldwin's activity would violate at least three existing policies, because residents who feed feral cats are considered harboring them on their property and therefore assume de facto ownership responsibilities that bring them in violation of other city rules, prohibiting animals from roaming at large, and requiring residents to provide the animal with adequate shelter and vaccines. Animal control dishes out fines in these scenarios frequently, sources say. The Indy asked Tatum if she believed Animal Crow was illegally fining residents. Tatum replied, my email to you from yesterday remains correct, but that is all we can comment on at this time. The proposed policy would outlaw residents in the city from owning an ark full of menacing beasts, including big cats, crocodiles, and venomous snakes, but it also goes on to ban residents from owning or feeding more run-of-the-mill critters like opossums, squirrels, raccoons, and ducks. Baldwin, among others on the council, felt the draft policy went too far. She said, "You'll be finding me at my house every day. I have my favorite feral cat, and he's like one of the family. That, to me, goes a little too far." And she added with a chuckle, "But I'll tell you what, I'll still feed that feral cat and let you find me. So there." Baldwin might have been joking, but it wasn't funny to Animal Control Officer Lauren Mullity, who is also an owner and rehabilitator of exotic animals. After watching the virtual meeting, Mullity fired off an email to Baldwin and the council, informing them that she's already breaking city code. Feral cats are actually a big problem in Raleigh that Mullity's department deals with regularly, and yes, officers do find people for feeding them. Not only can feral cats be a public health hazard, animal control responds to several feral cat bites each year, but they also spread disease and wreak havoc on local wildlife. Mullity wrote, "Feral cats pose and already inflict more damage than any of the exotic animals' owners' pets combined in Raleigh." And she goes on, "It's extremely upsetting to hear you say that it is taking it too far to not allow feeding of feral cats, and that your feral cat is part of the family, while the exact potential ordinance being discussed is what will require owners, such as myself, to be rid of their very own animals, animals that we consider our beloved family members. My animals that will be considered dangerous under this potential ban are also part of my family." Mullity told Indy, "She wrote the email as a concerned citizen. I didn't wish to comment farther." How did we go from talking about zebra cobras to feral cats? Has the council, in trying to fix an imaginary problem, stumbled onto a real one? More on that later. Here's how we got here. In July, a deadly zebra cobra slithered loose from an enclosure in North Raleigh, eluding capture while capturing headlines and striking fear into the hearts of neighbors. Everybody freaked out. The snake was eventually caught, and its owner, 21-year-old Christopher Gifford, pleaded guilty in court to several charges and was ordered to turn over 74 other venomous snakes in his possession and pay more than $13,000 in fines. Some would call that the system working, but not City Council member David Knight, who immediately spearheaded an ordinance that would prevent any more deadly creatures from running loose into the city ever again. But Knight's policy goes a lot further than banning just venomous snakes. It does that and prohibits folks from owning creatures such as big cats, bears, and crocodiles, but also pretty common local ones like opossums, raccoons, squirrels, and ducks. The definition of a wild and dangerous animal is, quote, "any non-domesticated animal that is inherently dangerous to humans or property." The ordinance also specifies animals banned are including but not limited to the aforementioned list. It also says you can't feed undomesticated animals. The existing city code doesn't directly ban the feeding of feral cats, but residents who do can be fined for up to 3 violations by animal control. When a resident feeds a feral feline for 3 consecutive days, they assume de facto ownership of it and can be fined for having it leave their property, failing to provide a proper shelter for it, and failing to have the animal vaccinated for rabies. Making matters worse, as one city employee told the Indy, during the COVID pandemic, the city was instructed to stop placing traps for residents calling in to report feral cats on their property, reducing their capacity to combat local feral population. As a result, the city's feral cat problem has likely exploded in the last year thanks to decreased enforcement. The employee, who didn't want to be named for fear of retaliation, said, "We don't track it. It's very hard to estimate that, but I'm 100% sure it's increased tenfold just because there's no one removing the cats." To be fair, animal control doesn't appear to have immediate plans to fine Baldwin. That'd be awkward. but her comments highlight certain hypocrisy in local government. The public safety threat of exotic animals, including venomous snakes, is mostly imaginary. Only about 5 people die from snake bites each year in the U.S., about 1 in 64 million people. Statistically, you are way more likely to get bitten by a feral cat. Most of the people that get attacked by exotic animals are the owners themselves, and these attacks grab headlines precisely because they're so novel and rare. Banning exotic animals won't stop people from owning them. As local wildlife educator Dan Breeding pointed out at the council meeting, it will just drive people underground. What could create a problem, however, is a regulatory overreach in the form of an overzealous ban on wild and dangerous animals that would force a tiny city department, Raleigh has just 8 animal control officers, to dedicate their already thin resources to seizing people's pets. The ordinance specifies residents will have just 90 days to come into compliance. Then what? Will an animal control officer have to come remove a panther from someone's basement? The employee I spoke to assured me officers do not want to do that, nor do they have the resources. 75 snakes were more than enough. Knight said, I hope not, but would not be surprised in a city in our size there may be somebody out there that has possession of some large cat. The question is, should the rest of us be put at risk for a very small population doing what they want to do? Meanwhile, the city's very real feral cat problem was somehow turned into a punchline. As Knight pointed out, ask any wildlife expert if you should field wild animals. They'll tell you no. It's often bad for the animal and disrupts local ecosystems. It's a truth many residents won't want to hear, including Raleigh resident Martha Brock, who has fallen in love with feeding a flock of wild ducks in the pond behind her apartment. Brock, a 71-year-old retiree, has done her research. She knows bread is bad for ducks, so she feeds them corn. And policy or not, Brock says she doesn't want to stop feeding her ducks. They can come after me with their nets. I don't care, Brock says, just as long as they don't come after the ducks with the nets. Government policy is tasked with cutting the difference between ideals and the realities of human behavior. In a perfect world, everyone would listen to experts and no one would feed wildlife, but we love our bird feeders and furry friends, so the Wild and Dangerous Animal Ordinance was referred to the Growth and Natural Resources Committee for further debate. Mayor Pro Tem Nicole Stewart, who chairs that committee, said she wasn't in support of the ordinance in its current form. She says, during these incredibly stressful times, we need to really consider all the ways that people find joys that aren't harming anyone else. I believe this type of pet ownership is bringing people a source of joy. The Indy asked if Baldwin still intended to cough up a $500 fine to feed her furry friend. We were awaiting a response. Our next article, I believe I have time for it all, is in the Stage section, written by Byron Woods, and it's called Paper Trail, and it's all about paper hand puppet interventions, a famous Chapel Hill institution for quite a few years now, 20 years, as a matter of fact, of these giant puppets and their productions all around the state. A new documentary, book, and show celebrate these 20 years of vibrant local theater troupe. The 20th anniversary is a major milestone for a theater troupe. Most don't make it to their 5th or 10th, but 2020 was no celebration year for paper hand puppet intervention. The venerated collective of artist activists who staged thought-provoking and conscience-challenging pageants with giant puppets since the turn of the century. The group's annual output has long hinged on a single show each summer, traditionally opening in August at Chapel Hill's Forest Theater, before closing the following month at Raleigh's North Carolina Museum of Art. But the pandemic posed an existential threat to the group when it forced it to cancel that season last summer. With little to no incoming revenue over 2 years, between the close of We Are Here in September 2019 and a hoped-for show this August, How could a collective of some 30 to 40 artisans possibly stay together? Co-founder Donovan Zimmerman says it was very hard at first, feeling like your whole career was crumbling away, like an illusion. But a number of supporters met the challenge by becoming subscribers to the group's Patreon account. Zimmerman says we had a sustaining amount that wasn't going to let us go away forever. That was amazing. With the group's survival more assured, the mandatory furlough gave Zimmerman and co-founder John Berger the time they'd never had before to devote to a long-desired project, a book documenting their first two decades of work. Paper Hand Puppet, Interventions in Cardboard, Cloth, and Clay, a 256-page coffee table tome available in hardback and softcover, is not only coming out as the group debuts its latest show this week at the Forest Theater, it appears as We Are Here, filmmaker Mark Levy's probing documentary of the group's 2019 season is screening in local venues. An exhibition of puppets at Carborough's Arts Center fills out an unlikely foursome, serving as a true celebration of the company's achievements. Zimmerman, without the pandemic, the book would not have come into existence. There's no way we would have been able to write it and get all the pictures compiled without that space. The first copies arrived 2 weeks ago at the group's studio in Saxapa Hall. It puts a capstone on a year-and-a-half effort to collect and chronicle the company's prolific output since its creator's first collaborations in the 1990s at the Haw River Festival. Virginia Chambers, a global health consultant and life coach who helped assemble the team that worked on the book, says, "It's total eye candy. It's a visual stroll through this amazing body of work they've nurtured, cultivated, and brought into being." The handsome volume is also a triumph against the subtle forces that always threaten the legacy of the live arts. Often scripts and photographs become theatrical productions, only surviving records. And despite their awesome presence on stage, the beautiful, giant hand-painted puppets that are Paper Hand's primary physical artifacts are particularly perishable because they're mostly made out of papier-mâché, fabric, and clay. In one chapter, the authors speak with pride of the dings and damage their works collect in various forms of community activism. Since the group routinely reuses old puppets to make new ones, often all that's left of the projects are pictures and sketchbook drawings. But even those can be scarce to come by. Zimmerman admits, "Archiving is one of the things that's fallen through the cracks for us." The search for artifacts and photos took the team into attics, the backs of old drawers and filing cabinets, an unused studio and office space. He says it took us half the year, at least. And Judith Winkler, the archivist, notes dryly, "The need for an organized body of work generally doesn't come up until you already have a disorganized body. Everybody has tons of old, unorganized photographs, but you have to collect them. That's the first step of history, and unless you organize your creative work and how it's produced, it will be lost." Winkler ultimately managed the archiving and curation of more than 7,000 images on the project. Chambers says Judith did an amazing job, not only curating the photos in the book, but figuring out how to move Donovan and Jan from the oral tradition they're accustomed to as storytellers to words on a page. Based on work at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke, Winkler interviewed Berger and Zimmerman over Zoom about old shows. He says she got us to dive into the pool of memory and bring the shows back to life. Chambers also interviewed cast and crew members, and the results really helped create a flow to the text very similar to the way they speak and think, she concludes. Designer Chris Crochetier brought Paper Hand's ideas to life, says David Perry, UNC Press's longtime editor-in-chief, who also worked on the project. Perry and Chambers both conclude the finished work conveys the ethos of its authors. And he says, "Those three strands, artistry, community building, and eco-activism, really shine throughout the book. all through this book, a cascade of vivid full-page images and illustrations feature an astonishing array of larger-than-life, mythic, iconic, and archetypical figures drawn from indigenous folktales across the globe. Dragons and phoenixes fly across its pages. Representation of the Earth Goddess and the Green Man calmly preside over a world populated by kinetic fire demons and elemental totems representing the deep peace of clear water and good earth. Comic naifs and inquisitive good-hearted children are juxtaposed against grotesques representing the horrors of unchecked climate change, corporate capitalism, and war. The range of stories told in 20 years impresses as well, from a breathtaking tableau vivant of Picasso's Guernica, after Colin Powell covered up the original at a 2003 press conference on the Iraq War, to the enlightenment of the Buddha. In that time, the tales of Gilgamesh and Mesopotamian creation myth have been staged alongside an improbable panorama of world thought leaders, from Thoreau and Darwin to naturalist Henri Fabre and the subcomandante Marcos. For Paperhand's new show, Unfolding Seeds, Invocations of Transformation, Donovan Zimmerman knew an art form outside of puppetry that could eloquently speak to a time of worldwide loss and brokenness, not only from the pandemic, but other social and political stressors. It's kintsugi, the Japanese art of ornamenting pieces of broken pottery by repairing them with bands of silver or gold. The name means golden joinery. But Zimmerman notes it could also be translated as the art of being broken. It's just a way of carrying our brokenness in a way that has some regenerative possibilities within it. Well, I must stop this last bit of this article now, but ncreadingservice.org is the place to rehear this episode of the Indie Week. Look for it, and dozens of other podcasts online. Until we hear you again, John Fetterson says goodbye for the Indie Week.